Name is Pete Steinke. The title of this session will be Spirituality, the One and the Many. I'm going to continue using the diagram, the paradigm that I used yesterday. The paradigm represents human relationships, and I would like to use this same paradigm to describe the human-divine relationship. For those of you who were not here yesterday, and even for those who are returning, let me briefly describe to you once again the paradigm. There are two basic human needs, two yearnings, two forces that every human being faces and confronts in his life or her life, and that is the need to be separate and also the need to be close. When one has the fear of separateness, one tends to emotionally fuse with other people. This means that one doesn't have a good sense of one's own individuality, where one begins and ends and where the other begins and ends. People get inside of each other's territory. John comes home angry. When John comes home angry, Mary is sad. When Mary is sad because John came home angry, then John feels guilty. When John feels guilty because Mary felt sad because he came home angry, and it just goes on and on and on. That's a fusion or a meshment. No one is taking responsibility for their self, but each one is reacting to the other emotionally. If one has difficulty with closeness, the tendency then is to go to the extreme of emotional distance, to cut off from the other person, and to become very rational, dogmatic, and opinionated. Where we would like to be is in the center, where I get my sense of who I am, what I will do, but in relationship to another person, not apart from another person, but in relationship to another person. I mentioned that the person who has a good sense of his or her boundaries is the person that will experience the greatest closeness, because one can let down the boundaries, get close to another person, then withdraw and put one's boundaries back up. Incidentally, the way a good separate person, a person who has defined who he or she is, gets close, the finest way to do it is through play, through ecstasy. And I know that I got to know my children best by playing with them. I still get to know people best by playing with them. I did mention that if people don't have the skill of playing to get close, and in playing let their boundaries down, some people then turn to anger or criticism to get close. And I mentioned yesterday that criticism, nagging, is fusing behavior. It's a way to keep somebody close to you by trying to evoke their reactivity to your reactivity, and then you just get into this cycle of reactivity. Okay, now I would like to represent this diagram as a possibility as understanding different types and forms of spirituality. If you look closely, when we look in the scripture, we're going to find God who wants to be separate, and yet God who wants to be close to that which he has created, particularly the creature. God in scripture, in the Old Testament, is called Yahweh. Yahweh means I am who I am. Could you come up with a better description of somebody who would be separate, who is self-defining? In the life of Yahweh's son, Yeshua bar Yosef, in Jesus, we find Jesus constantly using I am statements. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the resurrection. I am the good shepherd. I am the door. Jesus spends a lot of time in his ministry defining who he is with I am statements. I am who I am. So we sense God's separateness. Sometimes the title Yahweh is translated, I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But it is self-definition, it is separateness. But at the same time, God sends into our midst Emmanuel. And Emmanuel means Yahweh with us. The sense of closeness. The God who is other than we are still wants to be the God who is connected to us. Or look at this way. Yahweh also is described in a Hebrew word, kadosh. Kadosh means holy. Holy does not mean perfect, sinless. Kadosh means unique, special, set aside for God's purpose. So we talk about the holy church. We don't talk about a sinless, perfect church. We're talking about a group of baptized people set aside for God's purposes. So when God is described as holy, God is unique, separate from the rest of his creation. But yet we also know that God desires to draw close, to be near us. Luther used the phrases Deus absconditus and Deus revelatus, which is describing the same thing. Absconditus is the God in his hiddenness, God in his silence, God in his otherness. And this is the God we often do not understand. This is the God we often call to and we may not hear an answer from. But this is part of God's nature because God is holy and he is who he is. Now, the God who is revelatus, though, is the God who is near, the God who makes himself known. I like the doctrine of revelation because if you want to love somebody, you have to make yourself known to the other person. All advanced lovers make themselves known to people, especially to the loved one. So the doctrine of revelation is this advanced lover, Yahweh, wants to make himself known to his creature because God wants to be close to his creature. Now, if we would draw a line this way, we could come up with four quadrants. That's Carl Jung-like four quadrants. I'm not trying to mimic Carl Jung. I'm just saying we could do this. There could be a spirituality in which we emphasize distance in God's otherness. And that, in traditional terms, has been called deism. Deism is God created the world, and he did what? He let it go. He distanced himself from it. All right? There could be a God who we want to have close to us, this distant God, and we want him close to us constantly. And we can have that kind of God in pantheism. God is here. God is there. God is everywhere. God's in everything. You are God. Now, this is the good old New Age spirituality, by the way. It's very pantheistic. Shirley MacLaine and group say, all is one, one is all. God is you, you are God. It's pantheism. It's emotional fusion also. It's pathological. Because it's very borderline. That clingy, clutchy, fusy, not allowing for separateness. There is a book called The New Age Rage. And in it, the author, she's the head of spirituality counterfeits or something like that in California. Anybody know that book or that person? And she has a whole chapter on New Age spirituality in terms of its pathological nature, particularly the emphasis on pantheism. Now also over here in emotional fusion we'll see a lot of the holiness groups and the Pentecostal folks in a sense of being very emotionally fused with God, God being in them and so forth. And you could have over here, again, in emotional distance, a lot of Unitarians. Now, where are the Lutherans? Anybody want to tell me where to put the dot? Right here. In the middle. Now, don't make fun of Lutherans because they're always in the middle. But in a sense, we Lutherans live with constant tension. We live in the tension that God is other than we are. That's the whole message of Genesis, right? You're not God and I'm not God. God is God. And yet we know that God wants to draw near and be close to us. And we talk about the means of grace, the word and the sacrament. We Lutherans always live in tension because Luther's theology is built up of these dialectical categories. There is the law and there is the gospel. There is the God who is hidden and there's the God who is revealed. I always say we Lutherans do not live by faith alone. We also live by indigestion because there are these constant tensions. We don't resolve anything. Luther said we live under the unconditional demand of the law, and at the same time, we live under the unconditional promise of the gospel. The genius of Luther was he never resolved the tension. We always live in that paradox. We always live in the dialectic. We always live in that tension. But with that tension, there's always the possibility for growth and new life. Before I go any further, let me take any questions or comments. Yes? Excuse me? The God who is distant and fusion. Well, it's more really right here, towards the center. I haven't really thought out who belongs here. I don't want to categorize groups. I just want to give some generalizations, okay? Now, you could have some Lutherans who slip over towards here. You get some Lutherans slipping over anywhere whatsoever, okay? It's very difficult, by the way, to live with tensions because our natural human reaction to tension is what? To reduce it, to relieve it, to find some middle ground. But Luther has a wonderful expression. He calls it fide contra fidem. It's faith against faith. Well, that sounds weird. It's not rational, faith against faith. But what he meant is, he says, we always live in fear of God because of God's holiness, his otherness. Yet at the same time, we have filial confidence, trusting in God's promises. So we always live in this tension of God's otherness and holiness. He is not who I happen to be or anybody else. He's other. Yet at the same time, he's God who chooses and dwells among us. Fide contra fidem. But Luther says the filial confidence must always overcome the fear of God's otherness. And where does that filial confidence come? We Lutherans have said it comes through the Spirit working through the means of grace so that we can call God Abba, our Father. Any questions or comments on this? Now, let me take the concept of sin. Traditionally in the church, I think it's rather fascinating. Our concept of sin has been more emotional distancing. We have seen sin mostly as separation. For instance, Luther said sin is to be turned in on oneself, to be way over here into distance, incurvatus in se. Sin has been described by the Greek word hubris, which means kind of an arrogance, a separateness. We do not have many concepts of sin have to do with fusion at all. Most of them are about rebellion, separation. But we take concepts like faith. Faith happens to be more of a relational word. When Martin Luther wrote The Freedom of the Christian Man, he wrote these words. A Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none. Where is that on the chart? Over here, separateness. And at the same time, a Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all, puts him over towards the closeness side. Luther's describing in his treatise of the freedom of the Christian man exactly what we talked about here psychologically, these two needs to be separate and close. Listen to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Let him who cannot be alone beware of the community. Let him who is not in community beware of being alone. Bonhoeffer is repeating, in essence, the same thing Luther said about this need to be alone and separate and yet also to be close. There is a Jewish rabbi who, by the name of Edwin Friedman, a family systems theorist and a rabbi, And I've been doing some special training with him. And he's been mentioning to me how often in congregations he comes up and people say, well, that's not the Christian thing to do. He says, you know, even in synagogues they say that. That's not the Christian thing to do. And what do we mean by that's not the Christian thing to do? Well, sometimes we see separateness as sinfulness. But Friedman says, you know, if you really think about it, your faith has a lot to do with what you do with your solitude. What you do in terms of who you are and what you will do and will not do in terms of how you define yourself. We in the Protestant tradition have been more on towards the emphasis on the closeness side. And I said the other day, and I still feel, I don't know why there's so much de-selfing in the church. There's the difference between defining yourself and being selfish. Being selfish is totally going way over to the emotional distance side. But let me tell you, there's a lot of selfishness in Fusion. Because I may need you to be close to me to take care of me, not because I care about you, but because what? I'm scared to live alone. Or I can't live without you. So you can have selfishness on either end of this spectrum. And his emphasis, Friedman's that is that we have to emphasize a little bit more this whole side of the stewardship of the self. What does it mean that God has given me the stewardship or the management of this particular life? And how am I going to define it? And how am I going to define who I am in relationship to Christ that is also in relationship to other people? Questions, comments? Yes?
Can you once more say what you said about separateness often seen as sinfulness in the church?
Okay.
Well,
let's take Martin Luther. Hier stehe ich. Okay, where was Luther? Obviously, he's defining who he is. And Luther never wanted to really get outside of the church, correct? I mean, he wasn't way over here defining himself over against folks. He did get there when he got to the Pope. I mean, I think that was really some other stuff he was working on. Because he got his identity over against the Pope. You know, like making a statement like, when the Pope farts, the whole world smells it. At least the Pope thinks so. Those kinds of statements, that's really distancing. By the way, that's not too good material for preaching. I've never tried it, and I don't think I would. We don't seem to allow the fact that it's good for me to define who I am. I'm not talking Robert Schuller's self-esteem, possibility thinking. I'm not thinking of any of that stuff. I'm thinking it's okay for me to define who I am, and that's not selfishness. Because if there's not a self here, I really have very little to give to somebody else. What I'm going to do with somebody else is what? Enmesh with them, glob. And I'm going to feel whole only in relationship to you. Is that enough? By the way, I'm working on that in my book, and I'll be explaining more of that when I get into that. But that's what I'm trying to get at. I think too often we have equated being a good, solid, healthy self with selfishness. And we've missed up a lot of forsaking yourself and giving yourself to others. A lot of stuff is plain fusion. And I work with clergy who are really very fused with people, and they think they're really loving people. But they got a lot of dependency, codependency going on here. You know, if it says to deny yourself, there has to be a self, first of all, to what? To deny. There has to be a self to be given to somebody else. And like I said before, this is where we have the most dysfunctional families and operations, when people get their boundaries all tied up and mixed up, and people don't know where they begin and end and other people begin and end. Yes? Sin as?
You're saying that most people's notion of sin is of separateness. Sort of assuming that there's a better definition.
Well, I also want to say that I think there's sinfulness in violation of people's boundaries, where people, well, there's a lot of selfishness here. Well, I really like Luther's definition of sin the best, which is to be turned in on oneself. And I think in emotional fusion, you're turned in on yourself. I'm using the other person to be completed. I'm not really giving of myself for the benefit of the other. I'm using you to complete me. Over here, when I go into emotional distance, here one always gets their identity over against somebody else. I always have an enemy. So again, I'm really not relating to you in concern for your benefit. It's really for my benefit. So that turned in on oneself bit, that's for me is a good definition of sin.
How do you reconcile that with Tillich's definition of sin is simply our distance from God?
I don't think I have to reconcile. I think that would be an agreement. The separating from God? Well, yeah, and in terms of my separateness from God, where I'm turned in on myself. See, when I'm turned in on myself, I have no relationship. I'm into myself. That's who I relate to. So that would be synonymous with Tillich. Because Tillich uses three words, really, to describe sin. Concupiscence, alienation, and I forget the other one. There's one other one he uses to describe sin. Yes? Well, if I'm a solid self, I'm going to be concerned about you as an individual. I can allow you to have your separateness. I can give you more permission because I've done it for myself. Maybe I can compare that. I could not do therapy with somebody else if I had not had the training, the clinical training, plus doing therapy, being in therapy as a client myself. Because if I don't give myself permission to look at who I am, I'm not going to give you that permission. Why should I give you that permission if I can't give myself that permission? I will collude with you to help you continue to hide and conceal that which it is that you don't want to see. So in a sense, to be a solid self, I've taken a good look at who I am. I have an understanding of who I am. And one of the things I will say is that I'm a sinner. So therefore, I'm not going to stand over here far distance from you and judge you. But I will, as a solid self, come to you, and whether you're on either side, I'm going to accept you where you are. I'm not going to react to where you are right now.
If I accept another person's boundarylessness, I didn't feel
well, I have to accept that that's where you are. That's not maybe where I'm going to. I would really want you to remain if I have a concern for you. Okay.
It seems like the vertical dimension, the spiritual dimension, can come into play between two people when they respect each other's boundaries and encourage, maintaining even better.
Okay. Well, if I have a solid self and I value myself as a steward, as God's creature, I would want the same for you. Okay? Now, if you're emotionally fused, I've got to accept you, though, where you are. I can't say you've got to be a solid self for me to deal with you as a solid self. Encourages, correct, right. Think of the rich young ruler. The rich young ruler comes up to Jesus and says, I've kept all the commandments, what else do I need to do? And Jesus says, go all, take all that you have and sell. And what was his problem? He was very sad. I think the rich young ruler was pretty much a fuser, and Jesus says, go out and be separate. Sell all that you have. Or look at the prodigal son. All right? The young son, what does he do? Goes off to a far country. He's into emotional distance. Correct? All right? The older son, where is he? He's in fusion. Daddy, all these years I've done all these things for you, and you haven't even sacrificed a goat for me. See, all work righteousness is fusion. All work righteousness is emotional fusion. It's an attempt, you know, to pull God and there be no separateness. Oh, Daddy, all these years I did these things, and you did not so much sacrifice a goat. The waiting father says, you know, my son, you know, identifying the closeness, was lost and has been found. It is fitting to give him a feast. And I made a choice to give him the feast. He's into his separateness. Another story of in terms of how this kind of fits in. Now, I want to give you one other illustration. And I'm going to do a genogram. A genogram is a diagram of a family. And I'm going to diagram a family that I think is dysfunctional in the scripture. But when I say dysfunctional, that does not mean they're ineffective, flawed, inadequate human beings. I'm saying they're functioning. But God yet can use dysfunctional families for his purposes. And I'm talking about the marriage of Isaac and Rebekah. Abraham and Sarah, no children for a long time in life, and they have a son named Isaac. So you can imagine Abraham and Sarah more than likely heavily focused on Isaac, correct? After all these years, they probably over-focused on Isaac. Whether he was a spoiled brat or not, I don't know, but they over-focused on him. Let me embellish this a little bit, make it a nice story. All right. Isaac marries Rebekah. They have two sons, two twins. The oldest one is Esau. The youngest one is Jacob. Okay. All right, Jacob is mommy's boy. Esau is Isaac's boy. Now, there's something that happens here that I need to explain to you based on this diagram that I have not introduced you to yet, a concept. It's called triangulation. In every relationship involving two people, it will always be unstable. So every dyad, every couple, every partnership needs to find some way to bind the anxiety that exists between two people who come together and are different. They will become anxious, and out of their anxiousness become reactive to one another. So they could bind their anxiety. One could bind it by going into emotional distance, right? Just never be around. Just won't talk to you anymore. Give them the silent treatment. My friend calls that the microwave treatment. You let people stew in their own juices. You know, you just move away. Or you can go into emotional fusion where we really have no differences. You cover up all differences and make believe that we're just one happy couple and we haven't had an argument in 40 years. You also haven't had a marriage. But that's what can also happen. Now, there's a third way to bind anxiety, and that's a triangle. And this, every relationship, there's always the potential for a triangle. You're never out of it. What's a triangle? There's problem between A and B, and there's conflict and anxiety, so you bring in C. Let's go to the Bible. A, God. B, Adam. Conflict. Adam, where are you hiding? Where does Adam focus? Eve. Well, we take the conflict away from here, and where do we put it? On Eve. All right, God, Eve. Where does Eve put it? All right, now we got A and B, and the snake becomes C. So we've got the conflict focused on C. Somebody becomes the scapegoat, or someone becomes the identified patient. Someone becomes over-focused. In all dysfunctional families, you can discern the dysfunctioning because the family always over-focuses on the same person. They always bind the anxiety on the same person. Give you some example of triangles. Pastor, some people are saying, You see, really, the person saying that is angry with B, the pastor, and where's the focus? Some people are saying. You wouldn't really want to hear what other people are saying, would you? See, whenever you hear something mentioned about a third party, you've got a triangle. It's focusing to bind the anxiety by focusing on another person. It's in every relationship. You can't get out of them. The thing you need to do is to get into better positions so that the anxiety gets passed around. Somebody once said, the best leader is not the one who delegates responsibility, but the one who can delegate anxiety. So you get the anxiety passing throughout the whole emotional system. All right, this is what is called triangulation. Happens in every situation. I do a lot of consultation with clergy with congregations where the clergy and maybe the leadership is in conflict, or maybe a segment of the congregation is in conflict with another portion of the congregation. The first thing I always do is, what's going on in the antagonist family? One is a very super Lutheran, daughter joined Assembly of God's, son dropped out of the church. In another one, there was cancer and some other illnesses. There was something going on in each one of those families. All right, and there was tension then, correct? So where does it get focused? On to the clergy. Clergy, policemen, teachers, anybody in some kind of authority position or parent position stands to get triangulated. Family system theorist Carl Whitaker says, if you want to be a parent, you have to enjoy being hated. You're going to have to enjoy getting triangulated. But really, the key is to stay out of people's triangles. To recognize that it's being dumped in your lap when it really belongs somewhere else. Now, I can go in as a consultant and say, I'd like to sit down and talk with these families. And say, you know, you're trying to bind your anxiety here with the pastor when it really belongs back somewhere else. Now, pastors that are people pleasers, not sure of themselves, don't have a good sense of their own boundaries, get caught in all kinds of people's triangles, especially the pleasers. And they're always in triangles. And they're unhappy, and they burn out, and they're stressed, etc., etc., etc. Too many clergy become the congregational identified burnout, like the identified patient. Somebody who is over-focused on. All right. Now, what we have here is, why is Rebecca focused on Jacob? Why is Isaac focused on Esau? Well, for a family systems theorist, it would say something's going on in their marriage. That somewhere or other, there's some kind of conflict, anxiety. So in order to deal with that anxiety, what do? In this case, Isaac deals with it by focusing on Esau. In this case, Rebecca focuses it by dealing with Jacob. Who connives with Jacob to get the birthright for Jacob? Rebecca. See? Now, that's not healthy family functioning. For a wife to connive with her son against her other son to get something from her husband. That's unhealthy. I mean, it's just you wouldn't allow it in your own family. Whether it's in the Bible or not, it's unhealthy. Well, Jacob is kind of a wishy-washy fella. Esau was the hairy, strong one. Jacob was mommy's boy. He did anything anybody told him to do. So Laban, sharp old shrewd Laban, what does he do? Well, when Jacob wants to marry Rachel, right? What happens? Gets Leah, right? So you got to marry Leah first, okay? And then only later does he get Rachel. Well, Jacob finally grows up when he's at the wet banks of the Jabbok and has to fight with the angel. And then he begins to grow up, get some separateness. Give me a blessing. He defines himself. What's kind of interesting, though, is Laban is as tricky as Rebecca is. But this time, poor old Jacob gets to be in the C position of the triangle. You know, it's kind of interesting because there's also, what's Zilpah and the maidservant of Rachel? They also have children, correct? But who are the two sons of Rachel?
Benjamin
and Joseph, right. And who were Jacob's favorites? Benjamin and Jacob. Why was he over-focused on them and not the other 10 boys and one girl? Because you had a family system here where there tended to be an over-focus on one child to the exclusion of other children. So you have three generations here of beginning of some dysfunctioning. Well, that's just a way to take a look at that. And but to say also that God uses that, could use these folks to perform his purpose in life. I just wanted to use that biblical illustration of what a triangle is to create dysfunctioning. Now, what can happen very often here if God and any person, or let's say ourselves, let's put A and B. A is God. Okay. And B is me. There's always going to be anxiety here because of sin, because of the brokenness of life. So, what am I often going to do to deal with that anxiety between God and myself? I'm going to try to bind that anxiety on C. Find another scapegoat. I could sometimes find different ways to get out of this relationship. Simply say, forget God. Become an agnostic or an atheist. Or I could try to fuse God. You know, God's my buddy. He's my companion. He's this, he's that, and try to get in a fusion with God. But I've got to deal with the anxiety that's there between my God and myself. Now, I cannot theologically bind that anxiety. I do not have the power to do it. There's nothing that I can do. There's no triangle. There's no C that I can create or make that will be able to bind that anxiety. Only God can take the initiative to overcome that. And all of my attempts to bind that anxiety through other means are futile. Only God can reach out in Yahweh. I am who I am in his separateness and choosing for me. I was listening to a tape by Carlisle Marnie the other day. And anybody know Carlisle Marnie? He was an old Methodist preacher with a lot of wisdom. And he was talking about how God loved these people. And then he came to David and he said, and you know, God loved that bastard. He says, I don't know why God loved him, but he loved that bastard for only the reasons that God knew. Okay? Only God could overcome this anxiety that's there. There's no way that I can bind it. Not by my good works, not by any thoughts, not by any kind of action, but only through Jesus Christ. And all attempts to bind the anxiety between God and myself become futile. I must become open and to receive from the one who is truly separate and one who can truly forgive. Okay, comments or questions? How are we doing on time? Got time. Yes.
If you were from a dysfunctional family,
yes.
How do you develop yourself?
Okay. It's a very good question. Slowly. And I don't mean to be facetious, but give yourself time to develop that. Because remember, this is extremely strong. We actually are born in a fused state. A couple of lectures ago, I mentioned that we come into life and there's no distinction between mother and myself. It's all one. So we're extremely fused. We gradually grow out of that fusion. But if we grew up in a dysfunctional family, we weren't allowed to be separate. Or we showed any sign of separateness, we will pull back. So give yourself time. This is very powerful. But it means that you have to take some I positions. You have to take some I statements. You may need to work with somebody in therapy who can be that empathetic parent that you didn't have back here, who can give you permission to be separate, where there is very little threat when you do become separate. There's no magic. I don't have a magic formula. But it is possible. I've seen some people that I've worked with overcome some tremendous obstacles in the past, and they're just functioning at such a higher level. Yes?
On the surface, the redemption of Christ on the cross can almost seem like scapegoating and triangulation in an unhealthy sense. And sometimes it's had, maybe has even been portrayed that God beats on Jesus. You know, what makes it healthy in your opinion? I'm assuming that it is.
That Jesus is the scapegoat? That Jesus, that was his mission, and it was by choice. You could not do this, Jesus said to Pilate, if power had not been given to you. That Christ did become powerless and chose that C position to overcome that anxiety. And that this was God's desire, this was God's intent, this was God's purpose. So what looks like something very dysfunctional, God turned it around and made it highly functional in terms of salvation. Yes?
Is that to say then that God initiated triangulation and it's not always dysfunctional?
Well, you gotta distinguish. Are you talking about human reaction now, or are you talking about the human divine? I would say in a human divine situation, God permitted this triangulation. This was God's intent.
And human-human triangulation is not always dysfunctional.
Well, it's inevitable, put it that way. It would not necessarily always be dysfunctional, but if that's the only way you bind anxiety, it can become dysfunctional. And secondly, if you're always focusing on the same people or the same issues or the same way, it can be dysfunctional. Right. Well, I'm just saying it's inevitable in human life. And this is really, what I'm really saying is that community is based on threes, not twos. Because I'm saying that a dyad is always unstable. They have to do something with that anxiety. You can distance, you can fuse, you can triangle. But let's take, for instance, an alcoholic family where you have a bottle, a dependent, and an enabler. You know, you've got... Because the C doesn't always have to be a person. It could be a job. It could be a hobby. It could be anything. Any kind of over-involvement with something becomes the triangulation. I sometimes use this diagram when I work with couples. I want them to have what is called a no-exit decision, because I will not do marital therapy when somebody wants to get out of the marriage. They have to commit themselves to the process and will commit themselves to the marriage. So I have to do this exercise. There's four ways to get out of a marriage. Catastrophic ways, that is. One is homicide. And that happens. The other is suicide. Otherwise, just getting sick. Okay? Getting ill. Another way is going crazy. Or divorce. Catastrophic ways to get out. Now, there are some less catastrophic ways to distance and get out of a relationship. And that would be any way you're over-involved in something else so that the energy is not going into the relationship. Which is also saying, how are you triangulating other issues, substances, people, objects, ideas to get out of the relationship? An affair, for instance, is a triangle. A and B have anxiety. They're not able to bind it. So one tries to bind that anxiety by focusing on C, the affairy. But that doesn't handle the original anxiety, you see. What does it do? Triangles only redistribute the anxiety. It really never does bind the anxiety in human relationship. You're just relocated. Well, I don't want you to misunderstand triangle, because the triangle is to bind the anxiety between two people onto a third. And you and your spouse would not be trying to bind anxiety onto God. That's not to say that God is not within each of the partners and is present among the two. But triangulation means I'm trying to bind anxiety in a third party. I'm trying to get the anxiety away from A and B onto C. And I don't know if you would use God to get rid of the anxiety in a marriage. Church activities are a good way to get triangled. Yes?
A
what?
And call it God?
And call it God? Oh, could do that. Yeah. Well, let me see if I hear your question right. Is triangulation a loss of boundaries?
A and B
have anxiety. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, if A and B were a solid self, this anxiety would stay here, or more of it would. The less solid they are, they got to go to C. See what I'm talking about? So to answer your question, the poorer the boundaries A and B have, the more they're going to be reactive to each other, right? Caught in this anxiety, and try to focus then on C. Well, the more that A and B can handle the anxiety between themselves, the more they're going to be building their boundaries, their self-definition. Okay. The more they're scared of the anxiety and the more reactive they are because of the anxiety, the more they're going to have a C. Just inevitable. Pardon? That's right. I'd have less need to go to see.
Mm-hmm. You know, just to define clear sense of self in relationship, dealing with anxiety in a healthy way, maintaining boundaries, trying to use your concepts this way.
Yeah, well, you know, think of a Sunday school teacher. She's having trouble with a child and acting out in class. All right, so you get A, B, anxiety. The teacher becomes very reactive. She says, now, do you think God would have liked that? Who's to see? God. See, now the problem's between the child and God, not the teacher. All right? The teacher, if had a good sense of solid self, would say, you know, I've got to deal with this child. You know, I need you to be quiet now. See, you always get that you or focus somewhere else when you have problems dealing with your own self-definition, separateness. You bet. Because the anxiety should go where? To confession. Whether it's confession in church or confession to my spouse or somewhere, some kind of dialogue. Okay, some of you are getting confused now. A triangle is an emotional process, okay? And it is used to bind anxiety. Now, you made the question, where is the Holy Spirit? I'm not sure I'm following you. Yes.
If there's God, and God and I have an anxiety, and
I have anxiety with God.
Right.
By the way, it wouldn't be wrong to say that God would have some anxiety with, right? Because God had said, you know, I have a case with these people, you know.
And then Christ
is the mediator.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know how to answer that right at this point. Yeah. Anybody else?
Idea about Christianity is that it's a religion which is based on self-sacrifice, because Christ was crucified and this is what we're all trying to be like, and so we all need to go around and give ourselves away. And the problem that I have with that is that it leaves out these more obviously sophisticated notions about what that means.
Okay.
You know, how do you give yourself away if you don't have a self and all that? There's no place that really informs us about that that I'm aware of in the scripture. At least you have to really look hard to find it. And I wonder if that's part of the problem in our churches that you've been mentioning, is that it's hard to find that message and to really sell that message as part of Christian message. Is this making sense? The obvious thing that we see isn't informing us about all that's underneath it.
Yeah, well, I had a client who, for instance, she was abused as a child. Her father was very active in the church. In fact, he was the pastor. He totally violated his daughter's boundaries, totally invaded her. And, of course, she had no way. And she thought, you know, she was doing this for God. I mean, that's how her father, this is between you and me and God. And this is what God would want you to do with me. Well, I mean, that's total violation and craziness. Okay. And then some of that can be the same thing, that I think I'm really giving myself to another person when I'm really invading their territory of boundaries. I don't like hard sell evangelism. I think it's invading people's boundaries. It's a lack of respect. It's abuse. I'm all for good self-definition evangelism, which means I want to testify to you what I and whom I believe. You see, that's self-definition, not this violating boundaries. Maybe Scripture doesn't talk about all these psychological. All I'm trying to say is I'd like us to use some of these to help us understand who it is, what is it to be a human being, and how this can be related. Yes, next week I have a section I'm going to call When Theology Becomes Pathology. That's a whole other issue. That's next week.
Okay. You alluded to the fact at the beginning of this in a family system, in a triangle, that because there's the anxiety there, that if you triangulate in a family, you can pass the anxiety around.
Right, that's the healthiest way.
How do you do that? Okay.
Our youngest son, Matthew, when he was a toddler, he had to put up with a father, a mother, two older sisters, one older brother. So he often got in the C position. Matthew did it. See, anything between A and B, oh, Matthew did it. Matthew learned to talk and think for himself. So no longer did Matthew do everything. He was able then to say, Tim did it. Mom did it. Dad did it. See, then the anxiety was getting spread around. Does that help some way? It's so that you don't overfocus on. Correct. Right. Rather than to relocate it to see. Correct. And to deal with that tension demands that you have some pretty good separateness, that you can tolerate differences, and differences do not mean the relationship is over. Remember what, or maybe you weren't here yesterday, but I said in fusion, closeness is sameness. You have to think alike, feel alike, do the same things alike, etc. Okay. Here, when you have a nice sense of your own separateness, you're going to allow people to be different. You know, it makes sense that if you can have an opinion, that should in itself should guarantee the other person his or her opinion. Marcel calls that counterintolerance, or allowing somebody else to have the very same thing that you have taken for yourself. And that's what A and B in a healthy relationship would do.
Now, from a dysfunctional family system, however,
you cover it up.
You are told that you cannot have any other opinion but the opinion of, you know, the hierarchy in that system.
Right. Or if there's a problem, you hide it, the family secret. You can't talk about it. See, I just found out my family secret about 10 years ago. I found out that my mother's grandfather was Jewish. I didn't know that. And he lived with us, by the way, for 25 years. Came for a two-week visit and stayed for 25 years. And he was even a practicing Jew for a while. Converted later in life to Christianity. But I didn't know that growing up. That was the family secret. And, you know, my two uncles, his two sons, they're really biased against Jews. Well, I didn't think it was so bad. You know, Jesus, I got a little closer to Jesus or something, you know. But for some reason or other, that wasn't to be talked about. That wasn't to be a secret. There was another secret. My dad married my mom while he was in the seminary. And in those days, you'd be kicked out. So when I wanted to get married before I graduated from seminary, I didn't have any trouble. He already had taken permission. But see, those things, there are all kinds of those things that go on in your family. What is it that is hard for you to talk about? Then you know that's where some of the anxiety is. That's why as a therapist, I listen not just to what people are telling me, but what they're not telling me. What are they hiding? What are they concealing? And I usually know when I push the button. Because the person's going to change the subject. Person's going to be very reactive right away, get angry. See, there's certain kinds of buttons. You know that you hit something there, and you can dig around, excavate, be an archaeologist there. Another hand here. Yes?
Can someone who's an emotional, or the enmesher,
right?
Who does a lot of screaming and hollering about nobody cares about me, no one will talk to me, so actually be a distance?
No, but the complaining is always in a pursuit behavior, which is towards fusion. See, people criticize and complain because they can't ask for what they need.
Well, is it possible that that person can't get close to people either, truly?
Don't know how, that's right. See, we all have the same need to be close. We don't all have the same capacity to recruit that need, to have it satisfied. But you see, all frustrations are unmet needs. That's another thing I do when I go in conflict situations. You know, list down all of the frustrations you have with the pastor. Oh, boy, they go wild. Boom, 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 boom. Then I say, now change every frustration into a sentence that begins, I need from you. What happens? Now the focus is on where? The complainer, the person. See, it's a whole new ballgame. I need from you attention. I need from you 15-minute sermons. I miss my tea time or something. I don't know. See, so that's what I'm saying. When you're criticizing, nagging, you're in a pursuit position. You're fusing because you need something. And what is happening? You're not asking for it directly. Now, your needs as a child are your rights. But your needs as an adult are your responsibility. But if you grew up in a family where your feelings and your needs were not respected, it's very hard as an adult to ask for what you need and to allow those feelings to be what they are. Yeah. It takes time to get the courage to say that. And I will really honestly say the people that I work with, I don't look at them as flawed human beings. I see them very courageous people who want to do something about life and change. You know, sometimes people say, oh, yeah, Pete, you work with all the crazy people and the screwed up folks, and I turn around and say, no, I work with courageous people, and I really believe that. And I think there's a lot of courage that comes also in faith, that rather than looking for a C or criticizing, complaining, or blaming God, taking the courage to come in prayer, waiting, hoping, using the means of grace, being a part of Christian fellowship, is taking responsibility for what I need. I think that's what it is to be an imago Dei, to take responsibility for my life. I cannot take responsibility for salvation. I need to receive that. But I tend to take responsibility for who I am and what I choose to do in the rest of my life. My time is just about up. I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. Well, the thing is to try to stay out of the sea. Right, well, you work your way out of it. Let's say my wife and I are arguing, and then she'll say, well, Renee says this about you too. Renee's our oldest daughter. And now I could say, oh, I don't think Renee said that, and you're just saying that to get Renee, you know, I could go into all this reactivity, rather than say, just to stay out of it. And to define who I am. I heard what you said. I heard what you said. You said Renee said. But this is who I am. What I'm going to do, to take responsibility for myself rather than to react. That's how you keep out of those seas. Okay. Thank you very much. Probably about a year.
I
see. That time they publish it.
Yeah. You sure hit some real points there.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Your name is?
Make good sense. My name is Steinhaus, and I think what you're talking about in this pantheism is Ted Peters from seminary?
No, it was a female.
Oh.
He writes on New Age, but there's some female that wrote about it.
I see. Okay.
It's in a book called New Age Rage. Oh, Karen Hoyt, her name is. Karen,
who?
Karen Hoyt.
Oh, I see.
She has a book called New Age Rage.
Okay.
And she deals with the pathological parts of that New Age movement.